This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Culture and Society. We shall close with the news for young people. I am John Baptist Tumusime. The Holy See Press Office issued an update on Thursday on Pope Francis's health condition. According to the statement, in-depth blood tests carried out by medical doctors who are attending to the Pope show a slight improvement in his health condition. The Holy Father was admitted to Gemelli Catholic Hospital in Rome last Friday. Doctors discovered later that he was suffering from pneumonia. Pneumonia is an inflammatory condition of the lungs, which affects mainly the small air sacs. Its symptoms include a dry cough, chest pain, fever, and breathing difficulties. The disease is caused by a virus, but there are other types that are caused by bacteria. A follow-up workshop on safeguarding of minors for the Missionaries of Africa, commonly known as the White Fathers, for members who are serving in the Central Africa province, is underway in the Burundian capital, Bujumbura. The province consists of Burundi, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The workshop is organized by the Integrity in Ministry of the Congregation of the Missionaries of Africa, and is attended by 14 members from the three countries. A note issued by the coordinator of the Integrity Ministry, Father Laurent Kamwanza, said the aim is to review and update the safeguarding policy and codes of conduct for the Central Africa province in affirmation of the congregation's dedication to a safer and more accountable church in harmony with Pope Francis's call for transparency, care and responsibility in his apostolic letter entitled "You Are the Light of the World." In the letter, the Pope points out that the crimes of sexual abuse offend our Lord, cause physical, psychological and spiritual damage to the victims, and harm the community of the faithful. He reminds Catholics that Jesus is the light of the world and invites bishops, priests, women and men religious to model their lives on the example of Jesus Christ. The workshop opened on 15th of this month and is scheduled to close next Wednesday, February 26th. The first part was dedicated to understanding the laws on the protection of minors in the three countries of the Central Africa province. Experts have been invited to address the participants on key topics. Catholic bishops in the Central African Republic have appealed to the international community not to abandon the country, especially at this time when it is consolidating peace efforts. The Central African Republic is gradually emerging out of a deadly armed conflict that started in the late 1990s and continued up to around 2015. The people behind that conflict used religion as a factor, with Muslims encouraged to attack and kill Christians. Christian and Muslim religious leaders worked together to defuse the situation, preaching one common message that religion cannot be used as a tool to commit and to justify violence. In their recent appeal to donors, the bishops reiterated that religion does not divide, but connects people to one another. Muslims, Protestants, and Catholics and believers in African traditional religion must love each other because they are brothers. A bigger part of the Central African Republic is now experiencing peace after the armed groups reached agreement to cease hostilities and participate in the political and other activities of the country. The bishop's appeal comes after signs of indifference from the international community, especially as some donor countries withdraw from projects that have helped build and maintain peace in the country. The Association of Member Episcopal Conferences in Eastern Africa, AMECEA, launched last week the debt cancellation campaign in the region in accordance with the objectives of the ongoing Holy Year 2025. The association's coordinator of the Department of Promoting Integral Human Development, Father Paul Gweta, said a few days ago in Kenya's capital Nairobi that the debt burden in the Eastern African countries presents many challenges, including restricting the ability to invest in essential sectors like health and education, limiting economic growth by stifling innovation and infrastructure development, and in some cases, it is responsible for social and political instability in some communities. Father Igweta appealed to creditors to cancel the debts of poor countries and invited leaders of indebted countries to plan well and avoid unnecessary expenditures that have led to financial crisis. A Christian non-profit organization known as Oasis Network for Community Transformation concluded a few days ago a 2-week intensive Bible translation course in the Gambian capital Banjul with the aim to increase knowledge in sign language in religious texts among the deaf community in the Gambia. The initiative brought together linguists, Christian leaders, and members of the Christian deaf community to learn Bible in sign language and in the process advance their sign language communication abilities. The participants also discussed strategies for improving scripture translation and accessibility. The organizers and the participants described the training as good because of its focus on helping the deaf to grasp the meaning of God's word through sign language and appealed to religious leaders to include sign language in church activities. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
Kenya has reaffirmed its commitment to support peace efforts in Sudan. The move came a day after Khartoum accused the East African nation of violating its sovereignty by hosting a meeting of Sudan's Paramilitary Rapid Support Force, or RSF, in Nairobi. Kenya's foreign ministry said in a statement that the country hosts many Sudanese refugees and has a history of facilitating dialogue without any ulterior motive. In its statement, Sudan called Kenya's move to host the meeting tantamount to an act of hostility, particularly as it preceded a planned announcement of a parallel government by the RSF. The ongoing conflict in Sudan between the military and the RSF has killed more than 24,000 people and driven over 14 million people from their homes, according to the United Nations. Top United Nations officials in Africa warned an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on Wednesday that the offensive of Rwanda-backed rebels in mineral-rich Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is threatening peace in the wider region. The UN Special Envoy for the DRC, Bintou Keita, urged the Council to take urgent and decisive steps to avert a wider regional war. The seizure of major cities in eastern Congo by the M23 rebel group in recent weeks and statements by key parties show that the risk of a regional conflagration is more real today than ever before, said Huang Xia, UN Special Envoy for Africa's Great Lakes region, which includes the DRC, Burundi, Rwanda, and Uganda. Addressing the council, the French ambassador to the United Nations, Nicolas de Riviere, urged members to quickly adopt a draft resolution circulated by France 2 weeks ago that reaffirmed support for the DRC's territorial integrity and sovereignty. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
The This is Culture and Society, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba. The recent decision by the United States government to freeze foreign aid has sent shockwaves through humanitarian organizations. Trump and his aide, Elon Musk, say the six-decade-old aid agency and much of foreign assistance overall is out of line with the Republican president's agenda. Programs affected by Trump's executive order include aid for thousands of vulnerable refugees in precarious situations all over the world, prosthetics for war invalids in Ukraine, and demining projects in Sudan. State partners, aid organizations, and other non-government organizations are horrified and confused, as it is currently unclear what projects will be affected in the long term. Among the organizations profoundly affected is the Jesuit Refugee Service, JRS, which provides support and accompaniment to displaced people worldwide. The international director of the Jesuit Refugee Service is Brother Michael Schoff. In a recent interview with Vatican Radio's Linda Bodoni, Brother Schoff laments the fact that withdrawing dignity from one group today can lead to the same happening to all of us tomorrow.
We received the letter from the U.S. government on the 24th of January saying that all our projects are suspended from that day, the same day onwards. So it was a very abrupt disruption, no? And it actually concerned 9 projects in 9 countries with a total annual volume of $18 million. And that means it directly affected more than 100,000 refugees. Mostly programs were concerned in education. For example, in Eastern Chad, we have a huge education program with more than 10,000 students, but also in the area of mental health and psychosocial support, which is a vital area for refugees to rebuild their lives, areas of youth and community work and emergency support. This is unfortunately only the first wave, because these are the projects that were directly contracted with the U.S. government. We do expect a second wave once those organizations have decided what they will do with their U.S. funding freeze with which they are directly concerned.
So the whole network is suffering.
That is it. The U.S. Aid is over 40% of the total of the worldwide aid. So you can imagine the impact, and you can also imagine the way it was presented, how much people are left with essential services from one day to the next, which we find very difficult to transmit to the populations who we accompany.
You mentioned the situation of education in Chad that is immediately affected.
Let's go a little bit into the situation of Chad, because it's actually very typical. In Eastern Chad, which is a very volatile area, the education program concerns 10,000 students and 450 teachers. On top of that, there are 500 students enrolled in mental health activities, according to a diagnosis, and that is really necessary. And there is community support organized in terms of income-generating programs for the families. So imagine if you don't have that, or if you're not able to continue that, what will happen? You can guarantee that a huge number of students will drop out of schools, and you can basically go to the total number. You can also guarantee that these children will be much more at risk. What are they going to do the whole day, and who are they going to be welcome victims for? You can also see, and this is a typical effect of this new policy, that without the possibility to rebuild lives, tensions will increase and peace is at danger between refugees and refugee communities and host communities, between different parts of the refugee communities. So what we see at the moment is an incredible rise in the vulnerability of an incredible number of people.
I imagine that a lot of these children also have their meals at school.
Exactly, and that is the emergency component, so to speak. The project monies are now going to be examined, whether they serve the policies of the new U.S. administration. And there are certain waivers under discussion about what the U.S. administration calls life-saving activities. So what is life-saving? If you have something to drink and to eat, is that the end of life-saving? Because most probably you're not going to die. Or would you think that education and mental health services, which help you to reconstruct your life, is also life-saving and necessary to survive? This is, I think, this moment an important question under discussion.
I can imagine that many of the people you serve are refugees, obviously. Will they be pushed to migrate further, perhaps, if they feel services they have been benefiting of fail?
This is very unpredictable. We accompany refugees since 1980, and one experience that we make is they are people who take rational decisions. If you look along the migration routes that refugees normally take, very few of them plan their journey until the end. They plan to seek a safe space. So if this place where they are today is no longer safe, of course, it's a good probability that they will try to look for alternatives. What will happen if they don't find alternatives, I think, is the big question that nobody can answer, and is the big implication that this new policy will have. Because in a situation where you don't recognize the inherent human dignity of a person, you will not be able to build peace. I'm quoting from the letter that Pope Francis wrote recently to the United States bishops, where he says, well, everything which is started with force that doesn't recognize the truth of the human dignity starts badly and will end badly.
Faith-based organizations such as yours play a huge role in delivering aid and supporting vulnerable communities. Is there any way you can find another way to go forward without these funds?
If you look at the percentage of the US government funding in total development aid worldwide, it's somewhere just over 40%. And I think we have to recognize it's a huge contribution to the efforts that have been made worldwide. This is something which cannot be replaced by another country or another group of countries, nor church organizations or other groups. So I think if we say goodbye to multilateralism, and if we say goodbye to a world order that is value-based, there is no replacement. This is a departure into a new world order.
You say in your statement that you stand in unwavering solidarity with those forced to flee and you remain committed to staying by their side. How are you going to do that?
Jesuit Refugee Service started in 1980 with the accompaniment of refugees. So we are not first the service provider, but we are an organization that walks a certain amount of time, a number of weeks or years, together with refugees. And we are committed to doing that in any circumstances. The new context puts us in a fragility that refugees experience at this moment in a much increased way. And I think for us it is important to accept this fragility together with them. When I was reflecting on that, it is actually the experience of Christmas. The story of Christmas tells us that God chooses deliberately to become human, no? To identify with the people he sees, and that in the most precarious circumstances. I think this is what we are called to do as Jesuit Refugee Service. Of course, we need to do everything to provide as many services as we can, and we have launched an appeal to all Jesuit provinces, to all our major and most faithful donors, to help us in this emergency situation. We believe that we can raise 1.5 million US dollars for this period of 2 months, but this is emergency money just to bridge the disastrous consequences that refugees are experiencing at this moment. It is not a permanent solution. So I think we will enter into this period of fragility. We will do everything to make up, but it will not replace the world order that was a value-based world order.
Is there something the ordinary person on the street can do? Can we participate in your fundraising? Is there a donate button on your website?
You could go to our website, www.jrs.net, and we are set up for online donations if you would like to help. It's huge help for people in Chad, similar projects in Iraq and in further countries. And if you are donating to another charity that has lost the funds, I would encourage you to support that charity also in this difficult situation. Moreover, I think you have to recognize that withdrawing the dignity of a person is not something which is just happening to one group. That can happen to all of us in the future.
International Director of the Jesuit Refugee Service, Brother Michael Schoff, talking to Vatican Radio's Linda Bodoni about the implications on poor people of the recent decision by the United States government to freeze foreign aid. And that is all we have time for today in this edition of Culture and Society. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali, the head of the Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work branch of the International Labour Organization, has urged governments and their partners to act to eliminate child labour. Philippe Van Hunyingem made the call in his address at a recent World Leaders Summit on Children's Rights convened by Pope Francis. The meeting was held in the Vatican's Apostolic Palace on the 3rd of February. In his address, Mr. Van Hunyingem began by sharing on his encounter with a child labourer at a mine in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Children's rights are under pressure as never in recent times. 1 month ago, I had the privilege to visit one of our projects in a mine in Democratic Republic of Congo, and I met Jean-François, a 15-year-old boy who collects cobalt, who is so important for this critical device. There is today 160 million children like Jean-François in child labor. Half are in what we define hazardous work. 70% work in small-scale farming and small-scale mining. This figure comes from the ILO and UNICEF. This is a brutal and cruel injustice, and we just cannot be indifferent, as it was rightly said this morning. It is a question of living up to commitment the world has made to children. And the political will exists. 26 years ago, the ILO adopted the Convention 182 on the worst forms of child labour. In 2020, it became the very first ILO convention to reach universal ratification. It requires immediate and effective action to end abuse such as slavery, debt bondage, the use of children in armed conflict, commercial sexual exploitation of children, and hazardous work that put their health, safety, and even their lives in jeopardy. ILO Convention 138 complements this by establishing a minimum age for work, while ensuring that children's right to compulsory education is protected. These legal protections are essential, but implementation is lacking. So let me give basically three messages here. First, we know the solution. We know what to do. We need very clearly universal, free, and compulsory quality education. We need social protection so that families are not obliged to resource to child labour when a family member falls sick or lost his job. We need adequate enforcement, including by having more and better equipped labour inspection. And above all, we need decent work for the parents, for the adults, so they can earn enough to send their children to school and meet other basic needs. Secondly, we need a bit less words and a bit more action to take Jean-François out of child labour. Target 8.7 of the UN Sustainable Development Goals requires member states to take immediate and effective measures to eradicate forced labour, end modern slavery and human trafficking by 2030, and secure the prohibition and elimination of the worst forms of child labour, including recruitment and use of child labour by 2025, and ending child labour in all its forms. We know, unfortunately, that we will not reach the target for ending child labour. This is a moral failure that will resonate for decades to come. The hopes of tens of millions of children for a better future are seriously compromised, and whole society will be worse off as the cycle of poverty and child labour continues. But it is not a cause to give up hope. Our resolve must be stronger than ever. So this is my last and third message. We need more cooperation than ever. Government, trade union, businesses, civil society, faith-based organization, and affected community must work together. there is a huge potential to accelerate progress against child labour by improving coordination and promoting collective response. This is why in 2016 the ILO launched the Alliance 8.7, an inclusive global partnership with the mission to assist all UN member states to fulfil their commitment to achieve target 8.7. The Alliance brings together a wide range of stakeholders to collaborate, strategize, share knowledge on innovative approach. More recently, under the leadership of the ILO-DG, the Global Coalition for Social Justice has started. I truly encourage all organizations who are not already members of those vital partnerships to join. The Durban Call to Action adopted at the 5th Global Conference on the Elimination of Child Labour held in South Africa in 2020 sets out 49 concrete actions across a range of priorities. Implementation is really the key roadmap that must be done. In 2026, next year, the 6th Global Conference will be held in Morocco. It's a valuable opportunity to mobilize the global community to promote joint action at the scale required. Let's act together to meet the commitments made to children, relegate child labour to history, and give Jean-François a decent future and enjoy these fundamental labour rights.
That was Philippe Van Hoonjinghem, head of the Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work branch of the International Labour Organization, speaking at a recent World Leaders Summit on Children's Rights held in the Vatican. And that's all for this edition. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali.
You have been listening to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tumusime. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Development and the Economy. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.